I'm sitting here with my friend and mentor and all-around Shiro Alana Dyke Woman. Alana is one of the foremost lesbian cultural workers of our time and pretty much of any time. She's written 6 books and been published in many anthologies. For 8 years, she edited the international lesbian feminist journal Sinister Wisdom. Welcome, Alana.
Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Your first novel was River Finger Woman, and in an interview that I read with you, you said that that was the first book that was advertised in the New York Times that was identified as a lesbian book. And you wrote, at that time, my goal was to write a lesbian novel with a happy ending, which was revolutionary at that time. Can you tell us what you meant by that?
River Finger Woman got published in 1974, and I was writing it in 1971. And at that point in time, I had never read a lesbian novel with a happy ending. All our literature was either pulp novels in which the lesbians got punished or went straight, and that was the moral of the story. You would never be happy as a lesbian. Or in more mainstream literature, lesbians got bumped off regularly, like in D.H. Lawrence's The Fox, or in
The Well of Loneliness.
The Well of Loneliness.
The infamous Well of Loneliness.
The infamous Well of Loneliness, which marks the beginning of what we think of as contemporary lesbian literature. So although Gertrude Stein was writing kind of positive poems, they were extremely coded and nobody ever read them. I was on Daughters, Inc. second list. And on the first list, Ruby Fruit Jungle appeared, and it was probably among the very first novels with a happy ending. But even when Daughters advertised in the New York Times, they took out a full-page ad for their first 2 lists in the New York Times, and Ruby Fruit Jungle was on it, they didn't say it was a lesbian novel. They only said that River Finger Women was a lesbian novel. So that was my coming out to the world moment.
In researching for this piece, I learned some things I didn't know, including that you grew up partly in Puerto Rico. You grew up in a Jewish family, pretty strongly identified Jewish family, I think. So what was it like growing up in Puerto Rico?
There was a small Jewish community there. There were 3 groups of members of the Jewish community. One were people like my family whose businesses had sent them down for one reason or another to Puerto Rico. The largest portion of it, that community, were refugees from Europe, from the Holocaust. And the smaller contingent were Israelis. Some of them were actually spies for the Israeli government, I now realize. There was an agricultural exchange program between Puerto Rico and Israel, and a lot of that was a form of military and other kinds of intelligence gathering for the Israeli government.
Why in Puerto Rico?
Well, it's a kind of a gateway to the United States place. It's also a place where lots of undocumented workers from the Caribbean, especially, and from northern South America, make landfall into the United States in various ways. And because you don't need a passport to move from Puerto Rico to the United States, if they can get into Puerto Rico, they can come into the United States. And it's also close to Cuba. So there's that kind of military intelligence going on as well.
Interesting. So when and how did you decide that you were going to be a writer? Or did you know that you were going to be a writer?
I was always a writing person as a child. I was the kind of kid who turns in papers, and my mother would get called to school regularly and asked, why did you write this for your daughter? I was also, moving to Puerto Rico was also something that was a difficult transition for me, and I also was one of those kids who always knew they were a lesbian. So I was pretty clear that I was going to love women from the time I was about 3 years old. And by the time I was 12 or 13, I realized that this was an enormous problem. This was 1963. And so I was one of those adolescents who decided that they would have to kill themselves in order to cope with being a queer child. Fortunately, I didn't succeed, but I did leave home then when I was about 13 years old, 14 years old, and lived in all kinds of different kinds of institutions after that, and had a very interesting life. I don't want to be melodramatic about it, but I certainly understand how pressing it is for queer youth to come up against whatever barriers there are, because when I was a kid, there was nothing. There was no way to imagine even a happy lesbian story. The only idea that I had about lesbians was that they lived in alleys in Greenwich Village and wore leather jackets, and they would grab you, and they would get you somehow. And it was a terrible life to look forward to, and it was very frightening to me. And everybody kept telling me that I wasn't, and then I realized I was, and I was in big trouble, so.
Everybody kept telling you that you weren't a lesbian?
Yeah, that it was just a phase. You know, you go through, girls go through this, and you'll grow out of it. And I was totally aware that I would never grow out of it.
Your first book was published under the name Ilana Nachman, which right. was the name that you were born with, and your second was published under the name Ilana Dykewoman. Talk about that transition.
Around 1975, you know, the beginning of the women's movement and the lesbian movement, everybody changed their name to Wheatgrass and Stonehenge, whatever. I liked my first name, but I didn't like my patronymic, and my patronymic also ties me into a long religious Jewish history in Europe, into the Hasidim, and I didn't want to be known by that last name. So I thought, well, what am I? I'm a dyke and a woman, so. And I also thought at the time it was very important for me to stay identified as a cultural worker, which I saw as a different kind of calling than being some kind of star or, you know, media sensation, which Rita Mae Brown had become at that particular point in time. And there were other people in the women's movement who were, well, at least accused of being stars. There's a long discussion about what that means in a relatively powerless population. But I figured if I chose the name Dykewoman, nobody would ever review me in the New York Times, and that has remained true. Nobody ever has reviewed me in the New York Times.
That's somewhat surprising to me, because Beyond the Pale, which was your second novel, but about your fourth book, I think, got around a lot, I think, has been pretty widely read, fairly widely reviewed. It's a historical novel, not totally unlike some others that we might have read, in that it deals with the early history of the Jewish migration from Europe, from Eastern Europe to New York, the garment workers' strike, in which a lot of Jewish women were involved, and the Triangle Fire, but then it has some elements that are unusual. Talk about how you decided to write that novel and how you researched it.
I've always been really drawn to the Triangle Fire as an event. It's one of those kinds of things that if I believed in past lives, I would say in a past life I was either in it or witnessed it. Writers say this often, that they get characters that appear to them and demand that you write their stories. Sometime in my 20s, I started to hear the voice of this immigrant woman who wanted me to tell her story. And over the years, it became kind of a persistent knocking on the side of my consciousness, and she would give me a poem every once in a while. I knew some things about her. I knew that this woman had lost her lover in the Triangle Fire, and I decided I was trying to find out who she was. And so I figured out who she was, where she came from, what she had experienced, how she became a lesbian. And so I embarked on writing the book. The book took me 10 years to write and research. I always wanted to know more about, you know, the political life of the immigrants on the Lower East Side at the Progressive Era, which was a very exciting time. I found that the Progressive Era was actually a lot more progressive than any period in my life. You know, we had ideals and idealism, and we were out in the streets. I'm not saying that we haven't had some really great progressive moments. But back in the Progressive Era, the ideas of socialism and social equality and economic understanding of the world was a matter of constant discussion among all kinds of communities. And strikes happened weekly or even daily in some parts of New York, and some of the strikes lasted for 3 or 4 months under conditions of tremendous hardship that no one would put up with today. No one would even consider today the kinds of hardship that the people who brought us the 8-hour day were willing to put up with.
And was that research all archival, or were you able to talk with anyone who had been in the Triangle Fire? Or?
I never got to. Just as I was finishing the book, I found out that the last survivor of the Triangle Fire was still alive in Los Angeles, but I was done with the book then, so I didn't go down to talk to her. But I did get a lot of information at NYU. Their labor archives has tapes that you can listen to of women who were in the Triangle Fire. So I listened to some of those. And I got to read the letters of a number of the labor organizers from that time. There were many, in fact, lesbian women involved in the early days of the labor movement in the United States and in the progressive era. And some of them went on to become well-known labor activists and people who very much influenced the New Deal kinds of policies.
So if I can quote back to you some of your own words again, you said, I think in an interview, political movements that require individual sacrifice can only last for so long and will mostly appeal to younger people who are in the moment of change. But you continue to be politically active and you're no longer what most people would consider young. How do you remain inspired and engaged when so many of your contemporaries have not?
Well, many of my contemporaries have, and I'm inspired by those women who have. I mean, I used to, up until this year, do the Senior and Disability Access for the San Francisco Dyke March, for instance. And there were women on the Dyke March committee who were ranged in age from their late 20s to 68. And many of those women are the activists of my generation and the generation just ahead of me who have gone on to do a new kind of activism as they get old. I mean, part of it is that there's a romance, which is kind of a guy romance about activism when you're young, you know, that you'd be out in the streets and you pick up the gun and you're willing to die for the revolution. And at some point I realized that if there was going to be a revolution, it had to be a revolution that you could live for. Revolutions have to meet the needs of the people. And that includes the needs of revolutionaries, which revolutionaries forget. But revolutionaries need to have fun, to dance, to party, to do all those kinds of things, and to have comfortable beds to sleep in, because you can't work day after day and year after year with a bad back.
So how have your politics changed over the last 25 years?
Well, that's a very complicated question, but I mean, they're influenced by being in real time. I've become much more of an anti-war activist. I was always an anti-war activist. Many years I focused on lesbian activism and creating culture and cultural change and social change for lesbians and LGBT peoples. As I've gotten older, the causes of peace seem really important to me. And as a teacher, that's how I earn my living these days. It seems to me really important to keep the kids out of the army. You know, I mean, it's sort of as basic as that, to do as much as possible to make the alternatives to war and to living in a militarized and prison-dominated culture appealing. And so I'm willing to read and participate in the kinds of venues that I wouldn't 15 or 20 years ago. I used to read only for women, and that was important to me, and I think it's important for every cultural group to have spaces where they can come together. I still very much believe in women's spaces and lesbian spaces, and I also feel like it's important to go out in the world and to spread our ideas out in the world, because the world seems to be dying, actually.
This is Women's Magazine, and I'm Denny Bates. We're listening to Kate Raphael speaking with lesbian author and activist Alana Dykewoman.
You used to call yourself a lesbian separatist. Your first book of poetry, Fragments from Lesbos, was printed in 1981 for lesbians only. First of all, practically, how did that work?
Well, I printed it by hand. I used to also be a letterpress printer, so I advertised it in the lesbian journals of the time, and there were only 600 copies, so it was pretty easy to make it available only to lesbians, and it sold out.
And of course, there wasn't the internet then, so people had to be communicating in some real-time way.
Right. It was sold in women's bookstores, and nobody was actually policing it, but it managed to mostly be sold to lesbians. It was a kind of old idea, the idea, you know, that women have secret languages, you know, that we have had in like quilt making, and tapestry creation has often been considered a form of secret women's language where women can communicate with each other. And even, for instance, Yiddish was always called a woman's language, not the language that men would stoop to use until men took it over. But men talked either the languages of the country they were in or Hebrew. So there are many examples of this throughout culture. It's true in China, too. There are several women's languages that have been documented. And that was the idea, to foster a network of women's ways of understanding and trying to change the world through arts and culture and the words and the ways that we approach problems through language. I mean, that was my idea about it. How we use language deeply affects the realities around us. You know, institutions have all these kinds of horrible doublespeak kinds of languages, and they really affect and alienate people from how they operate, so that we end up having these incredible Wall Street bubbles because the language is so obscured, and I wanted to make it back into our own women's control. So in those kinds of ideas are ideas I still espouse, but they don't seem to be particularly practical at this point in time. I mean, in terms of getting published and getting your work disseminated. There were at least 20 kinds of separatism at the time that we understood separatism. You know, there was a land-based separatism, and there was an urban separatism, and there was an angry separatism, and there was a political separatism, and there was a redefining gender kind of separatism. So there were many different ways to understand that. I felt most closely allied, actually, with some friends I made in Quebec, in Montreal, who were friends of Monique Wittig's, and with some kind of idea of radical lesbianism that they didn't call separatism because of the separatist history of Quebec, that reexamined gender and said, you know, if we change the very basic nature of how we understand what a woman is, we can change the whole culture.
I think some people would say that the awareness of people on the trans spectrum and sort of the genderqueer identifications have made lesbian separatism an anachronism or no longer relevant. How do you see that relationship?
I think in some ways it's ironic because a lot of the kinds of ideas of the transgender movement came out of lesbian and early feminist redefining gender. And I see two different parts of the transgender movement, one of which seems to me to reinforce traditional gender roles, where we have the idea that there is such a thing as a man and a woman. It's something I've been personally baffled by and think is politically dangerous all my life. I mean, I never understood what it meant to feel like a woman, and it just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know either what it means to feel like a man. And maybe that is because I don't feel like either, but I also think that they are culturally defined ideas, that they're imposed on us from outside of us, and they are used to reinforce social norms. And there's another part of the trans movement that is absolutely about that, is about how there is no such thing as gender, and we can all be whoever we want to be in any given moment. Anybody can change their oil or wear a dress. And I think that is exactly what lesbians were talking about in 1974 or 5. I mean, that there was no such thing as gender. There was power and power relationships. And I think that analysis of power relationships is something that we don't see a lot right now.
I want to make sure that we have some time left to talk about your current writing, but I did want to ask how you reflect on the relationship between feminism and lesbianism in our culture.
Well, for many years, I was reluctant to call myself a feminist because I felt like if Alan Alda could call himself a feminist, then I wasn't. Some nice person who, male or female, who believes that, you know, women should have equal opportunity as long as it doesn't affect their paycheck too much. I thought that wasn't, you know, radical enough. And now I come to see that feminism is a kind of a code word for anybody who believes in basic human rights for women. And so I'm willing to call myself a lesbian feminist. The relationship between lesbianism and feminism has always been historically fraught, full of all kinds of tensions and questions like that about money and politics and power and relationships. you know, what I see when I look at the culture is how deeply rooted misogyny is. Misogyny seems to me often to be so much at the root of war and aggression. You know, I'm not going to act like a woman, God forbid, whatever a woman is. Whatever a woman is, it's the worst thing to be. The governor was famous for saying, we don't want those girly men. My students write plays, the women and the men, they write plays that are so misogynistic, so full of women hating how women, you know, can be brutalized and slapped around and killed at the end of their stories. They don't even see it. They don't even know it. They would know racism in an instant if they saw it or wrote it. But that they can't see it. After 40 years of working all my life for women's causes and lesbian causes, it's astounding to me that young women coming up don't see how misogynistic they themselves are.
It's interesting. I just saw La Mission, the movie by Peter and Benjamin Bratt, which is kind of wonderful if you're from San Francisco and a mission. You know, I lived in the mission for so many years, so there were so many things I loved about it. But when we left, I said to a friend, oh, but, you know, it seemed kind of old to me in terms of the gender politics. Like, it's not really that pervasive, is it, that people are always, like, putting down women and queers? And they were like, oh, absolutely. This was somebody who moves more in the straight male-oriented world. And they were like, oh, no, it seemed totally current and realistic to me.
But it's true. I mean, the worst thing to be in the world is a woman. And I find layers of internalized misogyny in myself frequently. I was at the Butch Conference, and there was a well-known writer who was talking about who identifies as a transgender person, and he was talking about how he didn't have any internalized misogyny, and at the same time, there was a whole section in the piece that he was reading about how he felt like he had betrayed himself by laughing like a girl. And I was like, and it was like totally right out there. Nobody commented. Nobody raised their hand. He didn't see it himself.
So your latest book is Risk. It's sort of a more contemporary lesbian story, certainly than Beyond the Pale, although it's set, I think, about 20 years in the past. And it's also partly about gambling. Why gambling? And what's going on in Risk?
Well, Risk is about taking risks, and gambling is a part of taking risks. And I've always been attracted to gambling, and not just gambling, but the kinds of interactions around money that go on in gambling and how people express themselves around money the most freely that you ever see it in a casino. Most people don't sit around talking about their relationships with money and class with each other. You see it played out in the casino floor in ways that you don't see it in regular life. So the main character is a woman whose father's been killed in the Vietnam War, which this book is covertly a book about, an anti-war book about how the effects of war set the generation's teeth on edge, generation after generation, and how we are all basically living in a PTSD world, a constantly renewed world of trauma from war. So the book is about taking risk and also about the risk that it is to form lesbian community and to deal with money and class in lesbian community, which she's trying to do.
You have some books open here, so did you have something you wanted to read?
You know, before when you were talking about how I identified, in the preface to my last book of short stories, Moon Creek Road, which is only available for me because my publisher went out of business. It talks, I think, as eloquently as I can say off the top of my head anyway. So I'd like to read that. For me, writing is about taking the journey, about finding a way where everyone has told us no way exists. As a Jew outraged by the actions of the Israeli state, as an American appalled by the imperial arrogance of the country I reap the uneasy privileges of living in, as a lesbian, I exist in the vulnerable state of having no homeland, no sense that any place in the world belongs to me, except the stories we make together. What I hope and keep hoping is that women of every kind will find room in the world for their own stories, and that eventually, sooner rather than later, borders will stop making sense because our stories will no longer hinge on the empty language of turf, possession, and competition, but on the visions we bring to relationships. May our words remake the world.